From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Several big cities around the world have imposed curfews in recent weeks, but does keeping people off the streets really help maintain law and order? Plus, Hillary Clinton isn't the only female candidate to try and break the glass ceiling into the Oval Office. We'll introduce you to a woman who ran for president in the 1870s.
This was an era where a woman could not vote, could not enter a restaurant, a store, an establishment of any kind unless she was escorted by a man. It was controversial for women to do anything, but she had the foresight not to accept the way society was.
Then schools that have lots of poor students get something called Title I money from the federal government. But it turns out wealthier districts are getting money that should have gone to help poor kids. It's all coming up this hour. First, though, is the Atlanta way of policing still effective? Some current Black Lives Matter protesters say no.
There's a real epiphany that folks have when they see that they can reimagine what their existence looks like in this country, that we don't necessarily have to accept our conditions or accept the boxes that we're expected to live in.
That's Avery Jackson, an organizer with hashtag ATL is ready. We wanted to get your take on police relations and how to improve them. Here are your first thoughts. Roy Lee tweets, "It's not that City of Atlanta looks for diversity. White cops just don't apply there. They're all OTP. OTP stands for outside the perimeter. April says, "The Atlanta way simply doesn't work in this day and age." And Sam Burnham adds, "Mr. Rogers said it best. A policeman is a person in your neighborhood. They need to be a friend to community and warrior to crime." We love getting your thoughts, whether you tweet them or otherwise. You can call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457. Tweet like April and Sam and Roy at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Violent attacks against police in Dallas, Baton Rouge, and other cities have people worried about security and public safety. Last week, Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed considered the idea of a curfew after there were a wave of protests in the city. There are no definitive plans for a curfew at this time, but we wondered if curfews are effective and should Atlanta consider one for protests or other cities. Savannah has struggled with crime as well. Here to answer some of these questions is Mike Mayles. He's a senior researcher for the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice, and he joins us via Skype. Hi there, Mike.
Hi, how you doing?
Can we first talk about curfews and why they are instituted? Is it always in any city when they do curfews? Is it always because of a fear of violence?
Well, there are two kinds of curfews being talked about here. One is a general curfew for the whole public, in which everyone is banned from the streets, such as they did in Los Angeles after the 1992 civil disturbances there. And these are temporarily effective as long as they're very short-lived, they're very even-handedly enforced, and police and law enforcement handle it in a flexible manner, but they have to be very, very short-lived. You can't impose a general curfew for
What do you mean by short-lived, like a few days?
At most a few days. I really think that we really haven't tested these in the United States. Fortunately, we have not tested these as a general proposition for months and months, like some areas have done. But for a few days, yes, they seem to be effective. But you can imagine the public reaction if they were kept indoors for any lengthy period of time.
And the second type of curfew?
The second type of curfew is a curfew that's imposed only on youths. The United States is the only kind of country that does this kind of curfew. They are fairly widespread. They don't work at all. There's a mountain of research now on curfews that show that they simply do not work. In fact, they sometimes make the situation worse. So selectively imposed curfews just on certain populations are a very bad idea, and they're usually promoted by politicians that don't have any better ideas.
So when you say that they don't work, what does that mean?
Well, curfews imposed on youth or on the general public are designed to prevent crime by and further disturbance by preventing people from being in public. And the police can quickly identify people in public and remove them from public. And that's supposed to, in theory anyway, prevent crime. As I said, reduce the violence that is occurring during, say, a riot or a civil disturbance. Like I said, curfews that are imposed generally on everybody tend to work for a very short period of time. But curfews imposed selectively on youth do not work because their function then becomes to remove law-abiding youth from public, to waste police time in enforcing the curfew, and to create antagonistic relationships between the police and young people. And the result has not been to reduce crime, either by youths or in general, or to improve public safety, either involving young people or in general.
When we measure their effectiveness, do we also measure whether or not young people abide by the curfews?
There have been efforts to determine that. The Los Angeles Police Department, for example, intensively enforced the curfew in a few districts of the city back in the 1990s, and they found that even very intensive enforcement, using a lot of community volunteers as well as law enforcement, did not produce any reduction in crime or improvement in youth safety. As for other curfews in other cities, they've been applied with varying intensities, but they also have not worked, and they tend to suffer a loss of police enthusiasm for even enforcing them over time. So no, compliance with curfews is not very easy to enforce when they're applied selectively to young people.
We'd love to hear from you, our listeners, and whether or not you welcome a curfew in your neighborhood. Does a curfew make you feel safer? You can tweet us at OSD Talk or join the conversation on Facebook. My guest is Mike Mails. He's a senior researcher for the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice. We're talking about the effectiveness of curfews. So, Mike, when you start with this premise, I guess the idea, and I'm assuming here, the idea of a curfew is that removing law-abiding people from the streets means that those who are left are not law-abiding, and therefore the police can really pick out people who might be troublemakers. Why doesn't that work?
Well, again, if you're applying a general curfew to the whole population, it works temporarily, because then the police simply assume that everybody that's remaining on the streets is some kind of threat to law and order. And again, you don't see these curfews imposed unless there's a massive civil disturbance like the Los Angeles riots of the early 1990s. But again, if you impose a curfew selectively, then it becomes very hard for police to tell who is over 18, who is under 18, or whatever age has been established for the curfew. And they have to stop a lot of people. They have to enforce it very selectively, generally with a great deal of racial disparity in enforcement, in that African Americans and Hispanics are much more likely to be curfewed. And so it really doesn't work. And also they intend to enforce them over a longer period of time, which means that compliance goes down very rapidly and police have much more difficulty.
So, you know, for example, many people have pointed to the curfews in Baltimore as an example of curfews that do not work. And in fact, in some cases, crime increased in Baltimore after curfews were imposed. Why?
Well, again, this is a curfew imposed only selectively on youth, on young people. It's not enforced on the general population.
Now, you keep making this distinction about curfews that are imposed selectively, and I get that they're more difficult to enforce because it's difficult to know who's over 18 and who is under 18. Is that the only reason why a selective curfew would be different than a general one?
Well, other than just being very discriminatory, that would be the main difference. Yes, a selective curfew just targets a certain population.
Okay, so when we look at Baltimore, how do you make that connection, or do we make the connection between that, a selective curfew, and crime going up, or is there something else going on?
Well, over 90% of the violence, this is according to FBI clearance reports, in cities over 90% of the violence is committed by adults, 95% of the homicides. Generally, it's a spectacular homicide, a tragedy that provokes the enforcement of a curfew. Over 95% of these are committed by adults. So again, targeting a selective population is not only very troublesome, but it doesn't really get it at the populations that are causing the most problems in the first place. So the Baltimore curfew has not worked, and they've seen increased homicide there after the curfew, precisely because it only targets young people. And I'm not sure a general curfew would work either, as I pointed out before, but the curfew targeting young people definitely doesn't work.
You mean you're not sure a general curfew would work in Baltimore or any city that has experienced serious violence, such as Dallas?
Well, it would work temporarily. I mean, it did work in Los Angeles for a few days, but the law enforcement there was, and the city leaders there were intelligent enough to know that it really wouldn't work past a few days, that really you're going to get a great deal of public backlash against a curfew that's imposed for a large amount of time on themselves, on adults as well as youth.
So, I mean, I realize you're a senior researcher in all these statistics and data, so I don't want to take you too far outside of your comfort zone, but have you gotten any kind of understanding at why people feel that curfews are safer? Why do we keep returning to this tactic?
Well, youth curfews are politically popular because they don't affect a population whose rights are thought worth respecting in any way. Oftentimes, law enforcement and the news media and institutions have and political leaders have blamed crime in their cities on youth when actually they're much more caused by adults than by youth. Because young people are an easy population to target for blame and stigma. They don't have any voting rights or lobbying abilities or that sort of thing, and so or publicity, public relations abilities. So they're very easy to target politically, which makes it in a way even more disgraceful that law enforcement and other agencies are just targeting the a population that can't fight back.
So what then effect does that have on youth, especially as we look into how to get better relationships between police and especially young people, when you impose a curfew that it sounds like young people resent and that is selectively discriminatory, what effect does that have on the youth population of a city?
Well, it definitely tends to poison relationships between law enforcement and youth. And you can imagine how this would work. Anybody who's being taken off the street for doing nothing wrong, just being told, well, you have to go home, you cannot, or we'll arrest you and take you to the station. This is what happens in a lot of cases. We studied curfews in places like Vernon, Connecticut, in detail, looking at actual curfew citations, and we found that 99% of the youth removed from public were not doing anything wrong. They were just playing basketball or going to movies or going home from jobs or school events or that sort of thing. And so there's a great deal of resentment, as there would be in anybody, and police simply coming up to you and saying, we're going to arrest you simply because you're in public, not because you're doing something wrong. So we've had, for instance, a police chief in New Haven, Connecticut, which is a city that has a great problem with crime, decided against enforcing a curfew, and they put much more resources into police relationships with the community and with younger people and had much better results.
And there's also a possibility that curfews can be used to cut down on protests, which is not supposed to be the use of a curfew.
Well, again, curfews can also have a lot of nefarious results, and that's one of them, to simply banish protests that civic leaders are finding troublesome or irritating simply because of their political content. So, yes, there's a First Amendment question there, too.
Although, I mean, we only have 30 seconds left or so, but it sounds like the bottom line is that curfews do not really work once they pass 2 or 3 days?
No, cities want to be very careful in instituting curfews. It's not something where you just have some incidents or a disturbance. You need really a widespread insurrection type of disturbance that's creating a great deal of general violence. And then, of course, you could understand a temporary curfew on the population. But other than that, they're very unwise.
Mike Mails is a senior researcher for the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice. Mike, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. Democratic National Convention kicked off in Philadelphia last night. Senator Hillary Clinton is expected to accept the Democratic nomination this week. That makes her the first woman to represent a major party in a presidential election. Clinton's campaign is the closest a female candidate has been to the presidency in U.S. history, but it's far from the first. Victoria Woodhull ran for president in 1872. Her candidacy made her a trailblazer during a time that predated even women's suffrage. A TV documentary about Woodhull called America's Victoria was produced in 1998, and I spoke with the filmmaker Victoria Lynn Weston of Georgia last April. I started the conversation by asking, what made Victoria Woodhull's story so unique?
A lot of people don't realize that even though Victoria Woodhull was the first woman, she was also the first woman before women even had the right to vote. But what's interesting about her is that she grew up dirt poor. She had a rather violent childhood. Her father, Buck Kaplan, he was basically a petty criminal, and he would go out and burn down the barns to try to collect the insurance money. And she didn't even go to grade school. I think when she started, she was more around the age of 8.
Let me interrupt you there for just a second, Victoria, and try to take us back to the time and place that we're talking about here. This is a clip from Scott Claflin, a descendant of Victoria Woodhull's, and he's talking about sort of what rights women had and didn't have in the late 1800s.
This was an era where a woman could not vote, could not enter a restaurant, a store, an establishment of any kind unless she was escorted by a man. It was controversial for women to do anything, but she had the foresight not to accept the way society was.
So she ran in 1872 representing the Equal Rights Party. How did that come about?
Well, it came about is when she basically became friends with Cornelia Vanderbilt and then married Colonel Blood, and then basically developed a male brain trust. And these men really liked Victoria Woodhull. They liked her voice, her gift of oration, and the fact that she was gorgeous. So it was General Benjamin Butler that had invited her to speak, and she was also the first woman to speak for the House Judiciary Committee in 1870. And she talked about the 14th and 15th Amendment and argued that women had the right to vote because they were simply taxpayers. And because you're a taxpayer, that gave you the right to vote. And at that point, the black people were allowed to vote at that point as well. But they denied any women voting at that juncture. So then what happened is she became so popular that the women's suffrage movement, you know, with Susan B. Anthony and Katie Stanton, and Victoria wanted to be part of that group. But even Susan B. Anthony didn't like that because Victoria was had all these wonderful men, powerful, influential men
right.
around her, and she didn't like that. So they kind of shunned her. But well, that didn't stop her from moving on to the next step.
Right. Let's hear, actually, this is from the documentary film that you made. This is, I guess, an actress reading as Susan B. Anthony here.
If she were influenced by women's spirits, I might consent. But she is wholly owned and dominated by men's spirits, and I spurn the control of the whole lot of them.
And it seemed like, you know, this is a woman, I mean, I'm talking about Victoria Woodhull at this point. She was born poor, as you mentioned. She twice made her fortune and then lost it. She was a female stockbroker. She was a newspaper editor. This is a woman that was into a lot of things. That's fair to say, right?
Absolutely. Well, she was extremely ambitious. And she didn't really know where she was going to make her mark in the world. She knew that, you know, she was driven. She wanted to have success. And she had a bite of it, and then she'd lose it, and then rebuilt it again. As far as the stockbrokers, again, her in Tennessee, they were known as the queens of finance. They were the first women to do that. And then she opened up a newspaper, Woodhull Claflin Weekly. And probably the thing that really, you know, was the first downfall with Woodhull is she deplored hypocrisy. She couldn't stand anybody that was a hypocrite. And back to the platform that she ran on, free love, equal rights for men and women, but the free love movement meant that if you were married, you shouldn't be confined by laws. That if a couple fell out of love, they should be free to move on to somebody else without having to go through, you know, a divorce and that sort of thing.
Right. It wasn't the free love that we think of from, like, the 1960s and 70s. She meant your freedom to marry and divorce and then, choose whether or not to have children without anybody interfering. Not.
Right. So at that point, she decided that, you know, Reverend Henry Ward Beecher, who was one of the most popular liberal preachers at that time, that he should stand shoulder to shoulder with her and talk about this free love movement, because Beecher, after all, was having an affair in the church with Theodore Tilden's wife, after all. And she thought, well, here you're doing this behind closed doors. Come stand with me in the front, and let's go and let's campaign about this free love movement sort of thing. Of course, Beecher wouldn't have anything to do with that. He said, absolutely not. Well, that just really infuriated Woodhull, who decided to go ahead and write about him in the newspaper. Well, that infuriated further, you know, Beecher saying, oh, you're going to do that. I'm going to have you, you know, arrested for libel and this, that, and the other. And it became, this big lawsuit, if you will, because Woodhull ended up having to go to jail on election day for libel. And,
yeah.
And that was because of Beecher and that.
And she, I mean, there was a lot of criticism of her paper that published opinions on things like sex education, women's suffrage, of course, wearing short skirts, vegetarianism, and also legal prostitution. But let's take a listen here. This is Amanda Friskin talking about the fact that as a pioneer, Victoria Woodhull, for women at least, is kind of a little bit of a tarnished heroine.
You want someone really beyond reproach. You want the George Washington for women. And you don't get that with Woodhull. She was a flawed first, but she's still the first.
Amanda Friskin wrote a biography about Victoria Woodhull, but you know, let's talk about Election Day. As far as I could find, we don't know if there was even any votes cast for her, correct?
Well, what I had found years ago was that there actually was votes cast, and it was, you know, approximately 5,000 to 7,000 votes. Whether that's, you know, somebody can go through and confirm that's another thing. But that's what I found, that she did actually have some votes.
But didn't actually get any, certainly didn't get any traction, and it was a long time before we got another female candidate. What happened to her political career and all her other, many other careers? Because she lived until almost 1930. What happened after the election?
Well, after the election, I mean, she nominated herself for president, you know, not once, not twice, but up to four times. So, after the election, you know, she was still campaigning about free love and equal rights and this, that, and the other. But their friendship with Cornelius Vanderbilt, you know, spanned several years in that, and then he eventually died. And his son didn't want any, you know, any fallout and any legal issues with Victoria or the sister, so he paid them $100,000 to leave the country. So Victoria packed up everything, got on a ship with her sister, and they moved to England. She reinvented herself, or is what we would say today, rebranded herself and started campaigning again, but was really a proponent of eugenics at that point.
Oh.
Then she met a rich, wealthy, dashing banker, Biddulph Martin, and she married him. And then she still continued on with equal rights and did a lot for children, launched schools, did, you know, some really wonderful things that, you know, for charitable, you know, causes.
Just for those who don't recognize the term eugenics, that's the movement in which that used selective breeding and sterilization and thought there were superior and inferior races for the most part. But I wonder how you feel. Before we go, Victoria, give me your thoughts on her legacy. There, many people have, you know, as you just heard Amanda mention, that she was perhaps not the best pioneer that women could have chosen in politics, at least. What's your thought on that?
I think Woodhull is a wonderful woman. I think she's not flawed. I think she is a representation of the American dream. Here is an individual that had no education, was dirt poor, and she made something of herself. And she was successful, not in one area, but several areas. She was a publisher. She was a Wall Street broker. She made money on her own. And I think women can go away from that, and men too, that to think of Woodhull is to think of to be daring, outrageous, and courageous, and to go out there and do anything that you want to do. And she represents that.
And would we have had Hillary Clinton without Victoria Woodhull?
I don't think so. I think eventually, if say Woodhull wasn't there, then we go on to the next woman and that. I think it certainly paves the trail. If Hillary Clinton was the first one, we could say the same. She's a very flawed candidate. She has a lot of baggage around her too, but Hillary's a strong, independent woman. She knew what to do to get to this point, and she's going to do a wonderful job there. So flawed or not, you take those flaws and you smooth them out and you make the best of it.
That was Victoria Lynn Weston. She directed the film America's Victoria, Remembering Victoria Woodhull, about the first woman to run for U.S. president. I spoke with Weston last April.
We're clearly soldiers in petty coats and dauntless crusaders for women's votes.
This year marks a landmark anniversary for Atlanta. It's been 20 years since the city hosted the 1996 Summer Olympic Games. We looked back at the impact of the Games last week, including how the Olympics changed the city's culture.
One of the ways in which I was able to really become very critical of Atlanta's winning the bid and the hosting of the Olympic Games was through Dirty Southern Hip Hop, created by Organized Noise, Outkast, and Goody Mob. And a lot of their early music, particularly their first album, Southern Playlist of Calic Music, with Outkast and Goody Mob, speaks to the Olympification of Atlanta.
That's Maurice Hobson, an assistant professor of African American Studies at Georgia State University. He says the single Get Up, Get Out from Outkast's debut album provides a window into how Atlanta's African American community responded to the changes.
Get up, get out, and get something. Don't let the days of your life pass by. You need to get up, get out, and get something. Don't spend all your time trying to get high. You need to get up, get out, and get something.
The chorus of the song, which is crooned by CeeLo from the Goody Mob and CeeLo Green, talks about is a conversation around Black folk and apathy.
Sometimes I feel I'm just a disappointment to y'all. Every day I just lay around and I can't be found. Always asking, give me some, living life like a punk.
One of the things that I've come up with in my research is what I call the Olympification of a city, or the Olympification of Atlanta. And as we all know, Atlanta won the bid for the Olympic Games on September 18th, 1990.
95 years to the day that Booker T. Washington gave his speech entitled The Atlanta Compromise in Piedmont Park in 1895. And so what takes place as a result of Atlanta winning the Olympic bid is a movement of urban renewal, gentrification, neoliberalism, political economy, and a host of other things that really franchises the city for world consumption. But the result of franchising for the world is it disfranchises, criminalizes, and demonizes the poor of Atlanta who are overwhelmingly Black. I get as cruel and demeaning, sick of taking trash out of toilet bowl cleaning. But I'm also sick and tired of struggling. I never ever thought I'd have to resort to drug smuggling. Nah, that ain't what I'm about. See, no one just continue traveling this route without any doubt or fear. I know the Lord ain't brought me this far so he can drop me off here. Did I make myself clear? The interesting thing about this song for me is that when I was a child, a small child, born in the 70s, Maynard Jackson was considered to be a sacred cow by my parents. They all admired him as a major political mover and shaker. It was almost as if he was a god. And I remember as a child coming to Atlanta and my parents seeing him. And he was such a big man who would shake everyone's hands. And he had this really loud voice. And so in my mind, listening to my parents, Maynard Jackson was the good guy. But when my generation gets on the stage to talk about Maynard Jackson, they label him as crooked. And so the real question began to be, so what happened to the narrative of Maynard Jackson in the 70s and 80s to where my generation would be critical of him? And one of the things that I began to look at is the conversations around the Rodney King riots, the incident that took place in 1992. A player ain't a gangster, but a player can handle his business. You need to get up, get out, get something, smoke out, because it's all about money, money, money. Yeah, right. In March of 1991, a motorist in Los Angeles by the name of Rodney King was beaten unmercifully by the police. And so as a result, unrest broke out in many of the urban areas, and Atlanta was one of them. And so what you have are students from the Atlanta University Center that merged with young people from the west side of Atlanta that marched on downtown. And they felt that Maynard Jackson had turned their backs on him because he was more interested in keeping the face, the image of the city as this Olympic city and keeping up all of the development for the Olympics versus listening to the needs of these young people. As a result of this, Cameron Gibbs' rendition of Get Up, Get Out really talks about how Atlanta's fashioning as a Black Mecca, which is at the center of Atlanta hosting the Olympics, because hosting the Olympics shows that Atlanta had transcended the sordid racial history of the American South to become something of an America's newest international and world-class city. And so as a result of this, as this image of Atlanta is pushed forth, Cameron Gibbs' rendition of what's going on is laid out in this track. And it really begins to call some things into question, such as the militarization of the police, the prison industrial complex, and how Black Atlantans looked at the Black City Hall. So keep your eyes peeled from the Cobra unit, cause they know for jumping out of black Chevy trucks and through the ball. Here comes the red dogs. I'm busting out around the corner in my hole. Dipping from the area, I'm scared. So one of the bitches might wind up dead, cause I have no time for jail. Clapping cops, gouging bail, and crooked face Campo got the whole country thinking that my city is the big leg for 96. And so it is at that point that we begin to see Gip really begin to critique Maynard Jackson and actually make the statement, and Crooked Jackson got the whole country thinking that my city is the big lick for 96. Lick meaning that it is it's the newest and quickest way to make the massive amount of dollar. It's actually uber capitalist. How will you make it if you never even try? You need to get up, get out, and get something. Cause you and I got the truth for you and I. Organized Noise's music, Outkast and Goody Mob's music, really served as a kind of oral history to the issues that plagued Atlanta. And so when I listened to an Outkast or Goody Mob song from that era, I was able to go into archives and find court cases. I was able to find historic events. I was able to find policies that were created that are specifically detailed in Outkast music. And what I argue there is that Outkast and Goody Mob are sincerely detailing what they hear the community discuss. Police brutality. It's a conversation around, you know, education, joblessness, homelessness, all of these different kind of conversations that we can see through what I call the Olympification of Atlanta.
Maurice Hobson is an assistant professor of African American Studies at Georgia State University. He's also author of the forthcoming book, The Legend of the Black Mecca, Myth, Maxim, and the Making of an Olympic City. Coming up, an investigation uncovers how money set aside for disadvantaged students went into the pockets of wealthier schools. This is On Second Thought. The U.S. Department of Education has a program called Title I. It's designed to support school districts with a large number of low-income students. But a recent investigation by U.S. News & World Report found millions of dollars went to wealthier school districts instead. We have with us a member of the reporting team, Lauren Camera. She's an education reporter at U.S. News & World Reports and co-wrote that story. Good morning, Lauren.
Good morning.
And also we're joined by Jaquetta Jenkins. She's the Senior Director of Compensatory Programs with the Savannah-Chatham County Public School System. Her department is over Title I. Thank you so much for joining us as well, Jaquetta.
Good morning.
Lauren, you start with this really striking example of two schools in Virginia. The first school has more than a third of its students living below the poverty line and gets about, I think it was $700,000 or so from Title
yeah.
I. Another one is in Fairfax County. And for those people who don't know Fairfax County, it's an extremely wealthy district in area in Virginia. And that school gets $20 million in Title I funding, despite having so many wealthy kids. How can this even occur under the current rules?
Sure. So Title I is the largest, just to give a little bit of context, it's the largest federal K-12 program that the government operates. It's funded to the tune of $14.5 billion every year. And what our investigation found, as you pointed out, that $2.6 billion is actually going to these wealthy school districts like Fairfax.
I'm sorry, repeat that. $2.6
billion. $2.6
billion,
so almost $3 billion. That's about 20%. Is actually going to wealthy school districts. And these are places that, you know, receive a lot of state and local funding already, largely due to healthy property taxes. They have a lot of wraparound services already for the poor students that they do have, things like literacy and math programs, social services, counselors, nutrition programs, things like that. Unfortunately, one of the main reasons why this money is ending up in rich districts is because of the formula which is used to distribute the money. Now, these wealthier school districts aren't actually to blame for receiving it. They just happen to be on the lucky side of the lucky recipient, if you will, because the formula used to dole out this money actually places more weight on the number of poor students in a district than the concentration of poor students in the district. That allows money, for example, to flow to big school districts like Fairfax that might not have high poverty rates. I looked a little bit in Georgia to see if I could find a good example for you guys, and I noticed Cobb County, which is the 12th lowest child poverty rate in the state, but actually is the fifth highest recipient of Title I funds.
Okay, so Jaquetta, how important are Title I funds for the budgets of schools in low-income areas?
They are extremely important. I view Title I funds as an ability to leverage schools so that they can all be provided an opportunity to be on the same playing field or playing ground as other schools are that may have a higher economic status as far as the parents. Title I dollars, if used properly and if monitored correctly, can make a difference in those poverty schools.
So, Jaquetta, were you already aware of an issue in how they determine Title I funding? Because it sounds like if I have a big school where there's, say, 2,000 kids, and that means, you know, I have a certain number of kids living in poverty, that number may be higher than another school, even though that other school has 50% or close to low-income kids. Were you already aware that was an issue?
No, I was not aware that there is an issue with it.
Lauren, sorry.
From my standpoint as a Title I director, the way that the formula works, we have to ensure that we serve kids or schools that have 75% or higher poverty. You can go as low as 35%, but that is up to the school district to determine that, and the superintendent and the school board, if they want to go as low as 35%. But however, you must serve to 75%. So you may want to look at, you know, is it the best practice to go all the way to 35% versus stopping at 75% where you have the greatest poverty.
Lauren, Jaquetta just said her understanding was that you were supposed to have 75% low-income students. What does the formula actually say?
So I believe what Jaquetta is referring to is how the money is doled out from the district to the schools themselves. What our investigation looked at is how the money is given from the federal government to the states and then from the states to the districts. So school districts have a little bit of leeway in how they themselves distribute their Title I money to schools. And Jaquetta is correct in that. Often they try to target the schools in their district with the very most number of poor students, or perhaps the highest concentration of poor students. Usually the way they do that is based off of this metric called free and reduced price lunch, which is the number of students who qualify for their school nutrition program. But the formula that we looked at, which distributes the money to states and then from states to districts, again, takes into account and places more weight, as you mentioned, on the size of a school district, the number of poor students, if you will, versus the concentration of poor students. And, you know, we have had lots of superintendents and education policy experts tell us, you know, it's much better to be a poor student in a rich district than a rich student in a poor district. And, you know, it's important to note that there are poor students in every single school district, no matter how wealthy it might be. But, what mountains and mountains of research has shown is that it's much harder and more expensive to provide students living in concentrations of poverty with a great education. And that's sort of where, from our investigation, this Title I distribution of funding falls short.
So, Jaquetta, it sounded like you were enthusiastically agreeing with Lauren just said. Why is it that we should focus more on school districts that have a high concentration of poverty rather than high numbers?
I'm not necessarily clear on what you mean by high numbers, because, again, I look at it through, I'm an LEA, so I'm looking at it at the local level. If she would like to talk about the formula at the federal level or the state level, I would definitely recommend that you contact someone who deals with the Title I formula at that level. I can only speak at my level.
Okay.
At my level, we definitely look at, just as she stated, which I was agreeing upon, is the percentage of free and reduced to determine our allocation that we received, and from there we distribute it out.
What I'm trying to get at here, Jaquetta, is say a school has, like I said, 2,000 students, and 200 of them are within the poverty range. That's not a really high percentage, but it may be more students than a very small school that has a higher percentage of concentrated poverty. What difference do you see that might make in a school? If there's a school in a very poor district where a large number of the kids are poor, what difference does that make to how the school operates and the unique challenges for that school?
Well, again, I can only speak through the lenses of an LEA, a local education agency. And so from what I can interpret what you're saying is that number, if a district is a large district, it is reasonable that their poverty students may stretch among a larger geographic area. If you are a smaller district, then it makes sense that you will only have, some districts only have one middle, one high, one elementary, and the entire district is Title I.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's almost comparing, you know, a million to a thousand. It still has to go down to looking at the individual percentages by school and by state.
Right. That is Jaquetta Jenkins. She's the Senior Director of Compensatory Programs with Savannah-Chatham County Public School System. Her department is over Title I. Jaquetta, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
We are still joined by Lauren Camera of U.S. News & World Report. She co-authored this investigation into school districts getting millions in Title I funding, even though they don't have a larger percentage of poor students. Lauren, what difference does that make? And you guys interviewed a number of principals at some of these schools that still they barely have enough money to pay salaries for their teachers while they're competing with wealthier districts for these Title I dollars. So what difference does it make when Title I funds are appropriated in the way that they currently are?
Yeah, in some instances, it makes all the difference in the world. A lot of these smaller, relatively small, but very poor school districts that we did speak to, as you mentioned, are starved for funding in some cases. They are hemorrhaging teachers in some cases because they can't afford to provide good health benefits. And in some cases, some of them haven't been able to follow through with teacher salary increases that they've promised over a number of years. A lot of Title I funding is used for teacher salaries, and that means everything for some of the students in these school districts. If you have great teachers, you can have a great education system. And then in, you know, some other cases, there's no funding available for wraparound services, things like literacy and math programs for students who are falling behind, ensuring good technology and computer labs. So this money for some school districts can make all the difference in the world.
So what would it take to change this? It sounds almost as though, and I could be mischaracterizing it, but it's almost as though this is an unintended consequence.
So absolutely.
What would it require to change the way the formula works?
Yeah, this is very much an unintended consequence. And I think it's important to also point out that the funding has been better targeted since it was first. Since this program is, you know, has been in place since 1965, since the federal education law was first created under President Johnson. So this program has been in existence for a while, and it is important to note that it's gotten better and better at targeting poor students, but it still, as we found, egregiously misplaces some money. And there have been a lot of attempts to try and change this formula. It's just the way that formulas work, and it doesn't even have to do with this one in particular. It's just very politically challenging to change a formula. What you would need to do to change this formula is get Congress to agree on a new formula for distributing the funds. And as you might know, Congress just rewrote No Child Left Behind, and we have a new education law. It's called the Every Student Succeeds Act. And there were some lawmakers who did try to change the formula during that passage of the law at the end of last year. Unfortunately, they failed. If you think of it from a legislative point of view, changing a formula doesn't mean new funds are added to the pot. It means that the funds are shifted. So some areas that get a lot of money under a new formula will get less money, and those that maybe don't get a lot of money now might get more. So it's a politically difficult argument to make, even if you are a lawmaker who can morally understand that this is not good for the majority of America's students. If your district is going to get less money because of a formula change.
Right. And in some cases, millions.
Yes,
I mean, when you say less money,
millions
of dollars. The school that we discussed earlier, we're talking about a difference in $20 million.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, even if you can see that this is the morally the right thing to do, it's very hard politically to go back to your constituents and say, hey, I'm going to get less money for your school district. It's really hard.
But how do we know that this legislation and these funds were intended to target schools with high concentrations of poverty rather than schools that had a large number of poor students?
Well, they weren't originally designed necessarily to target concentrations, rather just to ensure that poor students have equal access to education as wealthier students. This was sort of the brainchild of LBJ, who himself grew up in a very poor rural part of Texas, who knew that this needed to be part of the civil rights movement, that poor students were not receiving the same education as wealthy students. And so that was the original intent behind the idea. As, you know, time has progressed, the formula has changed more and more. And today, this is what we are left with. But as I mentioned, mountains and mountains of research really has shown that it's much harder and more expensive to provide students living in concentrations of poverty with a great education. So this is not to say that, you know, there are, as I mentioned, you know, there are poor students in every single school district. And that's why changing this formula is so complicated, because even the wealthy school districts have come to depend on that Title I money. The school district that we visited in Fairfax, Virginia, which is one of the wealthiest counties in the entire country, happened to be a school district where more than 75% of students in that school are poor. And also, more than 75% of them speak their first language is a language other than English. Mm. So Title I money for them is really, really important, even though they are part of this very wealthy school district.
That is Lauren Camera. She's an education reporter for U.S. News and World Reports. Thank you so much. This report on Title I education you can find in the paper. You can also find a link at gpbnews.org. Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you.
That's our show for today, but we want to hear about your neighborhood school. How do you see funding going for your school? Does your school have the funds it needs? Should we as Americans take a closer look at how our tax dollars are allocated to schools? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can find us on Twitter as well, at OSD Talk, or post to Facebook. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.